I don't know. That's just what pedestrian, average, mediocre receivers do. What's up? What's up? My man Deion Sanders, we all right, huh? We all right? Yeah, we all right. We gonna go into the Super Bowl again, being all right.
You're listening to the Pedestrian Podcast, the official UK podcast for the Seattle Seahawks. Here are your hosts, Ross Bell, Stuart Court, and Adam Nathan. Go Hawks!
Welcome to the Pedestrian Podcast, still the only and official UK Seahawkers podcast. With two of our bags packed and ready to go, Ross is going to hide in, or a sulk. It might be that he couldn't quite fit his 13-foot frame into one of the cases and bring him with us to New York. So this week, with Ross on Skyscanner and StubHub already for 2018, it's myself, Stuart Corr, and I'm joined by the man who doubted my ability to finish a sandwich earlier this week, Mr. Adam Nathan. How are we, sir?
I'm good. I have to say that I'm not normally one for research at the best of times, but when you messaged me today saying, are we podding today, I actually thought we'd done all the podcasting for the week already. So, the well-informed garbage that I usually come out with will be even less informed than that. So, sorry in advance.
Yeah. This week we will preview the game in New York, which sees myself, as I said, and Adam make the trip out to the East Coast. We also caught up last week with James Mancini, the other half of the Pigskin podcast, to help us preview the game in New York. James is the other half of the Pigskin. We obviously spoke to Mark Payne a couple of times on this pod over the last year or so. We also go through all the news that broke over the bye week in Seahawks land, which includes now some clouded near futures and definitely long-term futures for some on the Seahawks roster, and have our usual spin through the other 31 with Lock and Shock and True or False. That is, by the way, Adam, your forewarning to get prepped for that part. But first,
if you hear tapping, it's NFL Week 7 schedule going into Google.
or looking out for a new music bed.
One of the two.
But first, it is something that we didn't expect to have to cover and are saddened by the fact that we are. Look deeper into that with our guest as we look ahead to the Bills on Monday night. Kevin, are you there?
I'm here.
How are we, Kevin?
I'm good, very well. How are you guys doing?
Not too bad, Kevin.
Better now.
We'd be better with 5 wins than 4 wins and a tie, but, you know, can't have it all your own way.
Hey, everybody would be better with one more or whatever it is.
Very true. not penalties, though. Not one more penalty.
So what's going on?
Nothing. That's what we were going to do is just go preview this week's game, obviously. Just want to thank you, first off, obviously, for joining us. It was really good to see you back in the chair on Sunday night. Was it good to be back in the studio?
You know what? I really enjoyed it, man. You know, but also, it's always great when you have, guests who are there to give out information, to have a good time, and there's no ego involved. So it was a perfect day for me. I mean, I really enjoyed one being back, but also the quality of guests that I had to work with.
Was there any mention of bounties made towards Mr. Boldinger after his comment?
No. We left that alone.
So that is the voice of long-time Sky Sports and NFL UK stalwart Kevin Cadle when he appeared on this podcast just short of a year ago, who I'm sure most people listen to this podcast are aware now. On Sunday night, Monday morning, Kevin Cadle sadly and suddenly passed away at the age of 62. Kevin was, to me, Adam, Ross, and so many other UK NFL fans of our generation, a constant in their early days of following and learning the sport. From that chair in the Sky Studios, Cadle was a warm presence who had gone from the British Basketball League courtside to the NFL's TV studio with ease. 18 months ago, us UK Seahawkers as a chapter sent a hopeful Facebook message to try and get Kevin to our first ever national meet up in Manchester. And Kevin obliged, driving all the way up from London, especially spending 2 hours or so, wasn't it, Adam?
Yeah, it was basically the full evening.
Yeah, 2 hours or so in our company in Manchester, taking a whole host of photos, as both ours and Facebook and Twitter timelines and feeds showed on Monday morning. So he shared his thoughts and stories with those in the room from his time growing up in Buffalo to his 15 or so years in the Sky studio. But obviously the picture of everyone with him, which made its way onto Facebook and Twitter earlier Monday, is one of the best from that night. Then last November, as this pod was slowly finding its feet, and some could argue still is trying to find its feet, Cadle did agree to come on here and help us preview the game against his hometown Buffalo Bills. A half hour spent hearing his unique style and cadence come through the speakers. It was a great way to spend a half hour and also talking ball with the big man. It just sucks, isn't it, Adam? And Adam, as you messaged us on Monday morning, you couldn't quite believe that you were writing it.
No, it's one of those that the way we consume news is obviously very different to how we used to in the past. And it was something that I saw came up on Twitter from the UK Basketball Association that we are sorry to announce, obviously, the passing. And it's one of those things that you look and you look and you look again, and just I was genuinely open mouthed. It's one of those things that you think is like a cartoon cliche when someone is left open mouthed. But I was stood there for 10 or 15 seconds, just completely dumbfounded. And it's one of those things that just doesn't seem fair. I know that's a bit of a sort of childish way to look at things, but certain things just don't deserve to happen in life. And this is certainly seemed like one of them to a guy who basically seemed to spend the majority of his adult life helping others, motivating others, and just being an all-round good egg. And so we obviously wish him and his family and his friends all the love and compassion that we can.
Yeah, most definitely. I think it's also a case where he possibly didn't quite realise the impact he had on the NFL UK. Obviously, Neil Reynolds put together a really, really well-done video, which must have been awful and really hard for him to do on Monday. The way he was talking about the impact that Kevin Cadle had on the wider NFL UK, it's something we didn't quite realise, which is even more of a shame that he didn't really seem to realise that while he was still around, having that impact, Adam.
Yeah, I mean, I think the measure of someone who is a true great in a community is that when there is a passing, you get all of the stories about how good they were, because you don't necessarily see them talking about it, you know, and what they do in the public and what they do to help people. But, you know, even if you just took Michael Carson's stories, or if you just took Neil Reynolds' stories, or even, you know, the ones that we've got about how helpful he was to us and how good he was as a person, even just hearing one of those sections of stories would suggest that he was a completely straight up and lovely, amazing guy. But when you put it together as a package, it's pretty clear that we lost someone pretty special. And it's generally one of those that's quite just still a bit of a shock and hard to get over.
Yeah, it's one of those where I read your message and kind of went, you want to go a bit cold, don't you, when you read it, as you say.
Yeah, completely. And the irony is that he is a guy who, as Neil Reynolds himself said, wasn't necessarily a guy that did X's and O's, but he's a guy that brought incredible amounts of humour to and colour to the sport. You know, if you ask me about Kevin Cadle, the two things I'll probably remember are him carving turkeys with Cecil on Thanksgiving, and also one of his most famous clips is when he was falling asleep in the middle of a Super Bowl one evening, just because it was probably about 4:30 in the morning. And I think that's, you know, the humour and the joviality that he brought to things is how he'd want to be remembered. And, you know, it can be, when you see a lot of older NFL fans, it almost seems a bit geeky and curmudgeonly at times. But I think he's a guy that managed to transcend it into the newer, younger generation, and made it a fun sport for us to watch and grow up to.
Yeah, most definitely. But yeah, it's a massive, massive shame. Really, really sad. So if anyone hasn't got the chance, really go and seek out the TalkSport NFL podcast with Nat Coombs and Mike Carson, who share some stories from him, and obviously also this week's Inside the Huddle podcast as well, with Neil Reynolds and Jeff Reinbold talking quite emotionally about their Sky colleague. But yeah, rest in peace to Kevin Cadle.
Hi, I'm Kevin Cadle, and you're not.
Yep, we continue on, and the Seahawks did spend their bye week co-penning letters with the commissioner and considering a move to add to their offensive line yet again. The look for reinforcements on the offensive line came with left guard and off-season signing Luke Jokel undergoing knee surgery. Pete Carroll said on Monday that he will be out for around a month. For all the doubt around Jokel when he arrived, honestly, through the summer, where it didn't really seem that he was locked in, which was strange for the early part of training camp, he's been pretty steady through the first month, and this is a blow on quite a few different levels, isn't it, Adam?
It certainly is. I mean, when he was signed, it was one of those that brought quite a lot of joking from the Jacksonville quarters of social media, who couldn't really believe we were giving that much money to a guy who was a complete bust, let's be honest, at left tackle. But he did show some signs at left guard of being a slightly better player in Jacksonville. And I think he's been, you know, easily solid. And I guess that's all, that's what we always ask for, just be solid. I don't know the game and the line play well enough to tell you if he's been exceptional, top 10, top 5 or whatever, but all I know is that he seems to be giving up less pressures and less sacks and giving Wilson a bit more time in the pocket from that position, which I guess is all we can ask. And so he's certainly going to be a big miss for 4 or 5 games.
Yeah, I think the thing with him is that we've said on this podcast, and everyone seems to be in agreement, that the O-line has looked better over the past 3-4 games. And when the improvement happens, you look to what's changed, and he's obviously one of the things that's changed because he wasn't there last year. So I think on that thing, like you, I don't really understand or know enough what the play calls are on the O-line, but when you watch, when you take it all into consideration, how the O-line looks as a whole, you kind of expect that someone with his experience and presence has played a role in that. So yeah, it is a bit of a blow, but to cover him, according to Tom Cable yesterday, it will be a timeshare, as ever ridiculous that is, the Seattle offensive line, between Mark Lewinsky and rookie Ethan Posich. That's just a bit of a strange way of doing things yet again, isn't it, Adam?
Yeah, I just don't know who is meant to be playing in which positions. I don't know how they designate these things. I thought Posich was a centre and then a guy that played on the right-hand side of the line, and now he's seemingly being shoved in that left. I don't know what Matt Tobin is there for if he's not the backup. So I thought he was the backup guy on the left-hand side, but then I guess Glowinski had probably his best season as a Seahawk as left guard last year, so that does seem slightly sensible, but I don't know. We'll have to see. It's a bit of a baptism of fire regardless this week, yeah, because it's not really how... the Giants have many flaws, but defensive front is not one of them. And, you know, whoever's going to come in is going to have to come in and do a 6 out of 10 job, or we're going to really struggle.
Yeah, it seemed like the easy, well, the simple thing to do with all the talk of Brandon Albert and Dwayne Brown over the weekend. Nothing come of either. But it seemed that the thinking would be to move Reese Odhiambo inside at left guard, where he played in college and got drafted because he played to a certain level at that position. That then to play someone like Tobin or even Posich on the left hand side, but it just seems like it's just on the fly again with Tom Cable's approach to it, and this obviously the wider coaching approach to it, doesn't it?
It does a little bit, but then I'm always the one that complains when people get moved around and kicked inside, yeah, and bumped outside. That. And yeah. I guess you could argue that Odhiambo is, I think he's certainly improving at left tackle.
Yeah.
We haven't got a left tackle for the rest of the season. And it's a question of, do you want to, you know, stick him inside where he might not be great and then have a bad left tackle? Whereas, you know, if he improves as a left tackle for the whole season, then it's probably overall a net positive.
Yeah, that's probably fair. A month, I guess, at the same position, he's going to do him more good, isn't it, I guess? Elsewhere, news broke just before we started recording this podcast, but it's yet to be formally announced that Pro Bowl defensive end Cliff Averill is on his way to the injured reserve list with the nerve and neck issues he has suffered with since taking a heel to the face to the chin, pretty much, when tackling Colts quarterback Jacoby Brissett on the Sunday night last month. It doesn't sound good for Averill's playing future, with Pete Carroll saying he's seen all the doctors he can, and that is going to be a big decision he's going to have to come to in the next few weeks. But as we did mention a couple of weeks ago, it doesn't look good for Averill's future, but it's just fast-tracked his end of his time in Seattle, isn't it, really, in the harshest way?
Yeah, well, it's twofold. We discussed over the summer that if you're looking at places where, you know, cap money is going to be reused elsewhere, his dead money was about $600,000 if he left at the end of this season. But,
yeah.
You know, I think when he got injured, it was a bit scary, and we were all hoping that it would be something that he could shake off and be back playing in 2 weeks. I have to say that from the perspective of what a good man he is, I would probably welcome the news that he was retiring for his own good. I mean, yeah, if he did retire off the back of this is, it's quite a scary injury, you know, getting kicked in the chin and it caused such damage. And, you know, I guess in an ideal world, you would hope that he could retire, a Super Bowl champion for the second time, and his last game at the CenturyLink, he could, you know, make win ice a game with a sack on, you know, Aaron Rodgers in a dream scenario to take us to the Super Bowl again. But I think this is the kind of injury that for a guy that wants to look after himself and, you know, clearly has a huge future as a philanthropist and, you know, as a guy who can help out in Haiti in the future. It, to me, this seems like a natural time that maybe he should step away from the game because this is just, this is a rough injury.
Yeah, all British German always talks about a car crash that happens every player in the NFL. It for some, it seems so innocuous. It was just he got clipped as he tackled Brissett from the end. It's had such a massive lingering effect on Cliff Averill. It's just a weird coincidence. Is it coincidence? I don't know if that's the right word, but it's just very strange. All the vicious hits that he's laid on, he's been involved in over the last few years over his NFL and football career, it's something so innocuous has possibly brought the curtain down on it, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it probably quite almost the way that sports work is that these innocuous things seem to have the longest lasting effect. Yeah. It's just not something you can legislate for, and no. you wonder if even if he did get back on the field, which, you know, ultimately if he did, then the best of luck to him, and you know, you'd hope that it's for as a Seahawk and that he plays his, you know, plays his ass off again for us as he has done for 3 or 4 years now. But you wonder if there'd be a mental block on going into certain situations. And, you know, if that did happen, then that is how people do get hurt seriously again. So I don't know. It's a tough decision for him and his family to make. But ultimately, all we can do at the minute is wish him all the best and hope that he has a speedy recovery.
Yeah, most definitely. If it is the end for Cliff Averill in Seattle, he will end his time in Seattle with 34.5 sacks on 91 tackles as well and forced 14 fumbles from a defensive end. That is something quite remarkable. The strip sack from Cliff Averill, there's nothing prettier really on a Seahawks defensive player. Michael Bennett says he calls him Stretch Armstrong because once he gets to the quarterback, his arms just stretch and stretch. If Averill, 34.5 sacks, season be at 9th overall in Seahawks franchise history for sacks, only 60-odd behind Jacob Green, who's far and away, like Largent is at receiver, the leading sack artist in Seahawks history. But with Bennett, Cliff Averill, that's quite a 2013 free agent payoff, isn't it, them two?
Yeah, you almost have to thank Matt Ryan and Tony Gonzalez for him being a Seahawk, I would imagine, because probably one of the worst. The pick in Super Bowl 49 was obviously just awful and has had a lasting effect on the team that they won't shake it off. That is what this team is defined by, unfortunately. But in terms of being gutted at the end of a game, I think that Atlanta game, having the previous 9 weeks, probably was the most exciting 9 weeks of Seahawk football I'd ever seen.
Yeah.
They were just carving teams apart. Wilson was using his legs. Sidney Rice was amazing. Lynch was probably at his most electric, or that was the start of his most electrifying period. And it all culminated in Atlanta moving the ball 60 yards and scoring a field goal against us after icing Matt Bryant, is it?
Yeah.
Icing him when he missed, and then he hits the winning field goal. That was just devastating. But
yeah,
it was that drive by Ryan and Gonzalez. And I think, was it Roddy White also made a catch?
I think it was Julio, wasn't it? I think
maybe it was Julio Jones, yeah. And that prompted Pete Carroll saying, "I need two pass rushes," and that probably was one of the most significant drives in Seahawks history because, of course, the signing of Cliff Averill and Michael Bennett probably changed the franchise ever since.
Yeah, there's also, if you fast forward a week, it's the field at FedEx Field against Washington, which saw Chris Clemens' knee explode, and obviously we played some guy off the street against the Falcons, and as you say, that all led to Averill and Bennett. But yeah, if it is the end of Cliff Averill, for every strip sack and the role he has played, as Adam said, in making the defense what it is and what it has been over the last 4 or 5 years, it is quite a doff of the cap, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's hard to sort of rank Seahawks that have been in the team for the last 5 years to the extent where I'd say it's almost a pointless venture. You know, people are going to like the Shermans or the Baldwins or whatever, but you know, in most other teams, the performance Averill has put in would be at least up for consideration for something like a ring of honor. He's just been amazing on and off the field. And he'll be sorely
most definitely. We will obviously keep an eye on that and that if any news breaks over the next week or so with any decision number 56 makes. On to this week, though, and the Seahawks return off the bye, and as myself and Anna, as we keep saying, make the trip to New York City to face the 1-5 Giants. Before we talk it over and go through it with some detail, I guess, we spoke with one half of the Pigskin podcast, James Messini, to discuss what was verging on depression over the 2017 Giants. He spoke before he took off last week for the West Coast, and he managed to see his Cal Bears stun the Washington State Cougars on Friday night. So here is what myself and Adam and James had to say about this week's game. Right, this week on the Pedestrian Podcast, this week we on the look across the sideline, we catch up with a New York Giants fan and the other half of the Pigskin Podcast. We've heard a few times from Mark. Here is his co-host, and I mean, and the star of the show, I'm sure he'll be quick to point out as well. Mr. James Messini, how are we, sir?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for having me on. Let's downplay the star of the show, not to the show. I'm very much just the chump in the corner on that podcast.
So before we get into the game at MetLife Stadium this weekend or next weekend, because breaking the fourth wall, we're recording this 10 days or so out, because weirdly, me and Adam are going to the East Coast, and James, the Giants fan, is going to the West Coast. So that's all very strange. But yeah, so how did you become a Giants fan, and why the Giants?
For me, it started off back with, and showing my age, it would be John Madden 92. on the, and I'm pushing myself here, on the Mega Drive. And it was purely as simple as the fact that they had the coolest kits on that. They were one of the teams you sort of start out with, and that's what got me into American football, to be perfectly honest. It comes from Madden, and they were the first team I played with, and I thought, yeah, that'll do. I'll stick with them. and yeah, I mean, I saw out a fairly bleak spell in the 90s, but it all started coming good, you know, obviously around 2007. So it's good, and obviously being a city that's, you know, you can visit fairly easily as well, it's just one of those things that you go and it's just quite easy to sort of be a Giants fan, although not this season.
So before the season started, obviously it's all gone a bit Pete Tong, but before the season, what were your expectation levels for this year?
The hubris was high at Messini Manors. You know, I was thinking, you know, this is probably a 10-win season. You know, surely Eric Flowers couldn't be that much worse. You know, he's had another season to learn and get better and really master the position of left tackle. So even though we didn't add, there must have been some confidence that the line was going to get better. Obviously, the defense is largely the same. And we drafted reasonably well as well. And it on paper, it looked like it should all click. In theory, it's been a very different episode.
It strikes me as, you know, the majority of the teams in the NFL are probably 8-8 teams, and it doesn't take a lot that makes 8-8, you know, 4-12, or it can be 12-4, or 12-4 maybe a bit high, but you know, 10-6 and 6-10 is not a big difference. And watching a lot of the Giants games, there's been moments in quite a few of them where, you know, 0-5 could easily have been 3-2.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, we've lost with the last play of the game twice. We've been in it in the fourth quarter in pretty much every game we've played. So it's a shrewd observation. You know, we could easily be looking at a much better record. However, a lot of that would be papering over some fairly large cracks in the Giants team, particularly on offense. The defense hasn't been stellar, or it's certainly not been up to last season standards, but perhaps that wasn't, you know, last season they were exceptionally good and did get them almost single-handedly to the playoffs. But the offense has definitely regressed, and without a running game, it's very hard to win in the NFL at the moment. There's no balance there at all, and Eli's getting up in years, and it makes it very, very challenging.
Yeah. So on the offensive side, does that start with the quarterback, or is it higher up than Eli?
You know what? I think a lot of it comes down to play calling as well. you know, it's very difficult for Eli Manning to create anything resembling a ferociously balanced offense if all you're calling is, you know, running back draws from shotgun and slant routes. It's not compatible with a balanced offense. Eli's working with what he's told to work with. He's looked better in recent weeks. He started very slow, but he's really starting to find some rhythm. He's made a couple of really sharp throws. The touchdown in week four against the Chargers being, you know, showing he's still got that big arm when he needs it. There've been some good points the week before as well against Tampa when he, you know, really threatened the needle to, Sterling Shepard. The guy can still play. So it's not all on Eli Manning. For me, a lot of it is play calling and some of the decisions you're making there. But again, without being able to develop a balanced run game, I mean, Wayne Gorman's running exceptionally well for a Giants running back. In under Ben McAdoo, but he's just not getting the carries. And whether that's just an experience thing or what have you, but he still sits fourth in the depth chart. And there just seems to be a push to try and get Paul Perkins and Shane Vereen a lot more involved. Well, fair enough. I mean, I'm not going to complain about Shane Vereen getting more involved, but Paul Perkins just doesn't look like he's got it. He doesn't look like he's come on at all.
Nice.
What's the view overall on McAdoo? I mean, as a person, he clearly is probably the second most lacking in self-esteem person in the NFL after Russell Wilson, with just general tragic behavior, especially when it comes to his haircut.
I always think Andy Reid's usually pretty low on self-esteem when he...
Do you think? I think he loves it.
Maybe not at the moment, but, you know, I always think he's a man that always carries himself like he's done something wrong. Wade Phillips as well. This is a separate podcast.
Something to dive into. Andy Reid's definitely like a couple of bad results away from the Krispy Kreme hot donut line. That's for sure. But what's the general view on McAdoo?
I think he's New York's always been reasonably. Whilst the media hasn't been, this fan base has usually been reasonably patient with their coaches and coordinators, knowing that, you know, the basis of the success in the past has come from time and temperament and waiting for things to unfold through thick and thin. I mean, you know, Coughlin's success did not come straight away. It took a good few years for that to really come off. And I think a lot of the fan base remember that. And whilst a lot of the NFL is becoming more of this sort of instant gratification league, it's not necessarily what you're seeing at the Giants. However, in the past few weeks, the nature of the defeats, just the lackluster performance, the lack of yardage, it has been deeply problematic. And there is a lot of talk now, and there are a lot of murmurs about play calling duties being taken off McAdoo and, you know, give him a bit of time to try and sort out everything else he's got going on. And I think that's probably the right move for him. I think he probably at this stage, depending on what happens in, you know, the upcoming games, I mean, the Seattle one's being, you know, a big one, It might be one of those things where the injuries could save him and save his job. Obviously, Odell going down, Marshall being Croc as well, and Sterling Shepard being a little bit in between. It might be one of those things that people look at and go, well, it's not really his fault that Odell got injured. We give him another year. But the way the results are going, if they continue on this trajectory, I think he sees out the season, but he probably doesn't make it out of January.
Yeah, so on the injuries, I mean, I can't remember seeing anything like that when the whole depth pretty much at one position was wiped out. So Odell Beckham, Brandon Marshall, Dwayne Harris have all joined 10 or 11 others on injured reserve with different foot and ankle issues. Obviously, you said Sterling Shepard is apparently day-to-day with an issue. Have you ever seen anything like that? And who is in line to step up? Roger Lewis seems to be the hot name on fantasy waiver wires and stuff. Is that something you see coming to fruition?
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy who's flattered to deceive in the past, but Tavares King's also going to get a look as well. Interestingly, earlier today, Ed Egan got called up from the practice squad to sort of help out with probably more slot duties. It's a hard situation. I can't help but blame myself. On Sunday, on Sunday evening, I found myself wearing a Victor Cruz jersey, and I almost feel like I've cursed the franchise, because by sort of lunchtime on Monday, there was already talk of Victor Cruz maybe getting a call up for a midweek workout. It's looking pretty bleak. I can't think of a position group that's been rocked quite so badly, quite so intensively in such a small space of time. I mean, you're talking in the space of, you know, two and a bit quarters. Yeah. It's pretty brutal. And the Giants offense, for all the talk of other people coming in and, you know, Evan Ingram's shown a little bit since he's been there, the offense pretty much works when Odell works. When Odell's not firing, it doesn't work. It is as blatant as that. We are fairly one dimensional from that perspective. It's pretty bleak.
With Ed Egan coming up joining Evan Ingram, are we thinking maybe Eddie the Eagle will be the third person to come on with double E alliteration to join the receiver core?
Yeah, or,
I don't know how else. I don't know, Eric Edman. He could play.
Yeah, I think we'll quickly do a Wikipedia search for other people with double E's in their name. It's good to know that in a period of random drug testing, the E's are very popular in New York. So.
Just quick look on their injured reserve list, Adam. Kevin Norwood is on the Giants' injured reserve list.
Top player. I've always said he's a top player.
So we were wondering where he is, and apparently he's on the Giants' IR. On the defensive side, James Watts. Obviously, Snacks Harrison, JPP, and Olivia Vernon last year really surprised a few with how they played. And you mentioned earlier that it's been a slight drop off this year. Is it a correctable issue, or is it more systemic, do you think?
I think it probably is correctable. That it just seems like they're not getting the pressure up front at the moment, and that's problematic. Vernon seems to be carrying some sort of knock. It's not quite clear what, but quite often when he comes off, he seems to be getting a bit of treatment sort of in between series. So that sort of suggests to me that there's probably something wrong there. And obviously, when that's not there, then it puts a bit more pressure on JPP and Co on the other side. Jay Bromley, I think, starting to come forward in the middle. There's a real need for something alongside Damon Harrison. He's really missing having a bigger bodied guy alongside him that can actually get after the quarterback. That's not his thing, obviously. He's a big old fashioned run stuffer, and he's still doing a very good job of that. And he's really put that defense, that front seven, on his back as well, and said, right, this is all on me. I'll lead this, which is great to see, because he is playing. He's still playing at the top of his game. The linebacker core has always been a bit of a mess for the Giants, pretty much since Antonio Pierce left. It's bleak. BJ Goodson has some good games, but he's been picked on the past few weeks. But the biggest issue is the regression of Eli Apple, who looks set to lose his starting place in the coming weeks. So yeah, that's that secondary, which has been, you know, lauded for a couple of, well, really last season, but the season before there was a lot of talk about, you know, the things that it could be, but particularly since you add Jenkins and Landon Collins has really come into his own, and Eli Apple, it just hasn't really shone in the way that it did last year. Just Eli Apple has, as we talked about on Pigskin Podcast last week, Eli Apple's sort of forgotten the stuff he was good at in college and just started becoming a sort of short tackler, but he's no longer that sort of anticipating, you know, quick twitch cornerback. He's lost some of that, and he has become a much, you know, he seems to be a much more rounded tackler, which, to be perfectly honest, a lot of the Giants haven't been tackling has been a big issue. We're still getting to running backs and wide receivers, but particularly running backs behind the line of scrimmage, and they're just breaking free for an extra 5 or 10 yards. So tackling has been really, really bad for the Giants this year, and that's something that I've not seen for years with the Giants. We've always been a fairly sure tackling side. So I don't know whether there's something within the coaching that's brought that on. But it's a bit, yeah, it's really frustrating to see at the moment.
Yeah, but just quickly back on the O-line, it's pretty much 1A and 1 with the Giants and Seahawks O-lines, it seems,
yes,
across the board. In Seattle, though, it's a lot of... It's seen as little investment, even if it's not, and a lot more is put on the coach and the coaching staff, with obviously Tom Cable the front of that. What's the deal with that unit in New York, and where's the blame often pointed? Is it the same coaches, or is it on just the players aren't good enough?
I think it's players aren't good enough, to be perfectly honest with you. I've seen today we're both having a look at Brandon Albert, yeah, which is a sort of
don't all rush at once, guys.
sign of the times. So the only two teams are looking at him are the two most desperate offensive lines in the country. I think it's a personnel issue. There's a real skill shortage. It's not for the want of trying. Apart from possibly Eric Flowers, who just looks like a man out of his depth.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's there's been a lot of tampering. Justin Pugh's played pretty much every position on the line apart from centre. But there's nothing at right tackle as well, and they know there's nothing at right tackle. Bobby Hart's just getting abused. John Jerry didn't look very solid last year. And it's also had a few injury issues as well, same with Hart, which means you're starting to see DJ Fluker coming into the team, and it's a very thin group that, I mean, there just isn't much depth in that offensive line, and what's there is pretty poor. So I think it's more than anything a talent shortage on the offensive line. But I mean, to give them their dues, Weston Richburg and Justin Pugh are creating some opportunities. But, you know, if your running backs aren't going to run through the holes you give them, I mean, what hope is there?
Yeah, that sounds very familiar, doesn't it, Adam?
Don't know what you're talking about, mate. My offensive line is solid these days.
I am sort of hoping that the Seahawks game is an opportunity for the Giants defense to get healthy and get some sacks, but I'm sure we'll find a way to plan.
Yeah, the universal confidence booster that is Risa Diambu, Jermaine Ifedi are in the Giants' near future.
To be fair, both have been better last year.
Yeah, especially, particularly Ifedi, I think.
I was going to say, I think Ifedi against the Rams had a really solid game.
Yeah.
The Seahawks have strongly adhered to the don't be shit mantra that I've been trying to instill for the last 2 years.
Yeah.
And I think that they've just about been unshit enough.
Yeah. Just out when the quarterback is fully healthy as well.
That is true.
So, it's been pretty much 15, 20 minutes of desperate, and I think you've possibly set the record for a podcast use of the word bleak, James. Is there any positivity in New York?
No.
No.
I mean, you look at the few shining examples, so I'd say the second-year players, so Sterling Shepard and Landon Collins, and, you know, those guys are playing really, really well at the moment, and they're taking their opportunities, and Evan Engram is starting to flash some ability as well, which is as much as you can hope for. Tight end is not an easy position to play as a rookie, but they're starting to use him more and more. I'd like to see him split out wide. I know this is something that Seahawks fans have been saying with Jimmy Graham as well. It's, you know, it's when you've got someone that athletic, you don't just want them to be a sort of inline classic tight end. You want to be splitting them around a bit more, and I'd like to see a bit more of that with Evan Engram. I think if we're looking at positives to come out of the injury situation, that's very hard to do. It's an increased role for Evan Engram, and certainly it's highly likely that he's going to have a far more sophisticated route tree to be working with. He's going to have to be burning the midnight oil with his playbooks over the next few weeks, I think. Yeah.
James, I'll stop you there. If you are going to have a very good tight end who can, you know, catch at the high point, box out safeties, what you'd rather do is get rid of him and bring in an injury-prone center, because that's what the Seahawks fans would much rather do, just so you know.
That's good to know.
Yeah, there's a massive weird still and a clamour for Max Unger still to be a Seahawk, and it's rather befuddling and annoying. You are someone who quite closely follows the college game and college ball. You're every year guy for the NFL UK Mark, amongst other things. So who's one player, obviously with the Giants or just a wider broach in mind, who's caught your attention heading into the 2018 edition of it all?
Well, I mean, catching my attention probably for the wrong reasons to a certain extent the past few weeks, it has to be Sam Darnold, who just hasn't done what you want him to do. And, you know, a couple of weeks ago you think, well, the Giants are going badly. Maybe they're gonna be in that sort of area where they might be contemplating something a bit more a bit more tasty at quarterback. And now I'm looking at that class going, oh, I'm not sure I want any of them. which is a bit of an issue. Luke Falk's probably the most interesting of the bunch for me at the moment.
I was gonna say, I think for the receivers that the Giants have got, Falk could be one of the best guys they could have.
In terms of the fit, he's probably the guy. And to be honest, where I still struggle to see the Giants getting more than sort of, with their schedule, which is incredibly tough, more than sort of two or three wins this season, they're probably still not going to be picking first overall. So they probably are going to be looking at that second tier. I think Sam Darnold probably, post-testing and everything, probably does still hold that edge as being the number one quarterback. But then I think it's a toss-up between the others. In terms of other players that have caught my eyes, I talked about him on the pod a couple of weeks ago. But I think the wide receiver group, and particularly Christian Kirk, looks like all kinds of fun to me. He's got that kind of Odell Beckham ability to him. The way he moves, you can throw him into the slot, you can play him out wide. He's impossible to cover, and he's having just a sort of quietly efficient season, which probably puts him, he's probably going to be a kind of guy who's in that sort of Seahawks range of being sort of in that, I suppose, 16 to 25 range.
Yeah, for what feels like about 5 years, my favourite player for this draft class has been Cortland Sutton from SMU. Mm. Adam, I think we talked about him last year on the pod, didn't we, Adam?
I think you talked about him every week on the
pod.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's so, so good. So he's the one in that wide receiver class, obviously James Washington as well. So with the quarterback and all the crop of quarterbacks coming in, do you see this being the final 2.5-3 months of Eli Manning in New York?
It's hard to say. I was actually thinking on the train home this evening, I wonder what Eli Manning's trade value is at the moment.
He's too much of an institution, isn't he, in New York?
Yeah, but if you sort of assume he is, but the NFL's changing. It's becoming this league of instant gratification. If you've got a brand new front office, you've got a brand new head coach, you've got brand new staff. If it's one of those terms that they think that's going to be the difference, then maybe it is. It's like the old question from a few years ago with the England football team. The question that was asked: would you drop David Beckham? The only man who said yes got the job. And, you know, it could be one of those situations. Would you get rid of Eli Manning? I don't see it personally. I think he'll probably stick around, but I don't think it will be his last year. I think we're more likely to see a sort of gradual handover to a new quarterback. Now, whether that comes next season or the season after, I don't know. But, I mean, he's not playing horrendously, but if you're picking in the top five, you've got to assume if you're a team like the Giants, that's only going to happen once in a blue moon. Yeah. So, you know, you go and take your franchise quarterback, and if you have to sit him for a year, you sit him for a year. But in reality, I mean, if Eli continues to sort of stutter a little bit, I could see him sort of gradually handing over sort of by about this time next season. I don't think that would be unrealistic. But at which point then you sort of start talking about that New York institution, Adam, and which is better for his legacy, to be the guy who has to sort of get benched or the guy who's traded away?
I don't know. I mean, Coughlin would seem like a natural guy to take him on, and probably the only guy where you could see, so it, like, he wouldn't look weird. He'd look weird in the Jacksonville uniform, because anyone looks weird in that crazy uniform. But I don't know. He seems like the kind of player that should be allowed to, you know, he should be allowed to finish at home, if that makes sense. And, you know, this is his home, and I just think it would be messy to have him moved around.
I think you're probably right, but unless he does retire, and I think he's still got a hunger for the game. I think he's still, you know, he still works incredibly hard, and you know, the point you made is true. I mean, New York is his home. It's, you know, he's got his charitable foundation there. He does a lot of work in particularly in the Jersey area. You know, he's an incredibly well liked guy whose leash is a lot longer than a lot of quarterbacks in that city would be and have been, particularly on the other on the other side. It's a really tricky one. But I think short of him offering to retire, I don't see how this ends well for him, but possibly that link with Tom Coughlin in Jacksonville is the way to do it. That he, you know, does like so many in New York and retires on the Florida coast.
So, what are you expecting from the Seahawks rolling in? Obviously, it's not been a smooth showing of for all season. It's been flashes of impressive. Offensive play, but what are you expecting to see from the Seahawks on the East Coast next week?
I think I suspect they probably find a way to run the ball, which is problematic. But the Giants seem to be a team that other teams can get healthy on at the moment, so it wouldn't surprise me if we see maybe someone like CJ Procise, who's probably best suited to mess with the Giants. Come through and have a reasonably
that would require him not being made of like glass or perspex. Or
no, it's fine because as noted earlier, the Giants can't tackle at the moment.
But I've seen sugar sculptures stronger than CJ Procise.
But I mean, I think the tackling will be an issue. I could see Russell Wilson probably scrambling for 100 yards. It sort of has one of those games. I think it'll probably be quite an unlucky game. I don't see it being particularly a particularly tidy or a particularly watchable game for anybody who aren't fans of the two sides playing. I would expect the Seahawks to win just because of their superior quality on defense, and just everything seems to be clicking a little bit better for you. As you notice that. You mentioned that Russell Wilson's starting to get fit and get healthy, and you know Doug Baldwin always has a good game against the Giants as well. And it's you know, even when he had Charlie Whitehurst, you know, tossing and balls. So you know it's
Flipboard Jesus.
It's one of those. He's one of those guys that sort of always seems to do well against New York. So I would expect. I don't see them shutting out the Giants, but I suspect it's probably going to be reasonably one sided. I'm going to go for somewhere in the region of 30-10.
Okay. So more importantly, on a much closer. What's the Bears Cougars score going to be on Friday?
Well, thanks for yet another depressing result. for that. Well, you know, all optimism seems to have been sapped out of Berkeley at the moment. So, again, we're talking about Luke Falk. Luke Falk's, you know, in reasonably good form at the moment. He's taken a Washington team that, you know, could well end up being ranked in the top 15. I mean, currently they are, and if they continue on this trajectory, they probably will be by the end of it. The only possibility is, you know, obviously losing to Washington. It's, you know, an almost, I would say, almost a certainty at this stage. The defense needs to play a lot better. The offense just they can't run the ball at the moment, which is a real problem. And Bowers is starting to show signs of inexperience, which is to be expected. That said, barring that game against Nevada, I've not seen too much from the Cougars' defense. So I think there are probably points to be scored against them. I think they probably end up winning it, but it's probably going to be, you know, a reasonably tight game for at least three quarters.
Yeah. Well, me and Adam hope that it's the home field and all that on Friday.
Well, so do I. You know, it's not, you know, it's only an 11 and a half hour flight for me to go and watch them lose. So,
James, you mentioned that obviously it's a great city to be a fan of New York. For the listening millions that are invariably plugged into this podcast right now, what sort of tips can you give Stuart and I and the other fans that are heading out there next week to go and watch the game? What to do in New York that's maybe slightly off the beaten track, and where's best to go around the stadium and things like that?
I would say avoid Manhattan.
I'm staying there, so that's over
yeah,
one.
Yeah, yeah,
that's great. That's great. Yeah, everybody will be staying there. Use it as a base. Go and see the big sites, and then head straight to Brooklyn. Go to Williamsburg. It's really cool. There are some brilliant bars and some excellent places to watch watch football. And then go down to Red Hook, where there are some brilliant breweries, and also some just really good views of New York as well. But you know, October's a brilliant time to be in New York. It's lost that kind of oppressive heat, but it's before it gets bloody freezing. So it's a good place to be. But yeah, I always try and stay after the sort of first couple of times. I always try and avoid Manhattan. It's like every big city. You know, you come down to London or you go to Paris or what have you, the big cities are always at their sort of least interesting right in the middle. Push out a little bit and see what you can find. As for the stadium, get out there and get back as quickly as you possibly can. It's basically a large complex in the middle of a parking lot somewhere in Jersey. I wouldn't worry too much about spending too much time in the immediate area.
Where's my best game hot dog going to come from? Have you got any particular stalls?
I'd always go and see the Big Blue Crew in the lot. They're always serving them up home and away.
Awesome. Cool. So where can people catch yourself on social media? And obviously you've got the Pigskin Podcast as well, James.
Yeah, we are at on Twitter at Pigskin Podcast. I'm also at SNL_football for the hottest of hot takes. And I think we're also on Facebook as well. But if you, most of the action comes through through our Twitter account. So Mark's super active on that. And yeah, you can download Pigskin Podcast from all your usual sources, iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, all the rest of them. So when you finish listening to this one, try and listen to Alan. Yep. And it's probably not nearly as entertaining, but it's mostly me rambling. So so if you've enjoyed that bit of it, maybe you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, you clearly haven't listened if you think that ours is more entertaining.
Yeah, I mean, do a bit of research, James. Come on.
research is every analyst's worst nightmare. Just hot takes.
Yeah, there's been plenty of them. About 15 months ago, Adam said Christian Michael's a top 10 running back in the NFL. So that was at the start of the podcast. So.
Yeah, I told you it was entertaining.
Yeah, yeah.
It nearly worked.
Right, yeah, massively appreciate you coming on. It's quite late at night before you obviously have your massive long-haul flight to the West Coast of America. Enjoy your time at the game on Friday. Enjoy your trip up to Vegas as well, sir. And thank you for joining
us
on the pod. We'll have to try and get you back when it's next year.
See you guys in the playoffs.
Yeah. What, the NFC Championship?
Yeah, the 2018 NFC, the 2019, I guess, is the NFC Championship game. So we'll put that in the diaries, I think, when it's Sam Darnold against Russell Wilson, yeah?
Yeah, very light pencil.
Yeah, very, very tight. Well, thanks for having me on, guys. It's been really good fun, and enjoy your trip to New York. It's a great place.
Cool. Thanks very much.
Pressure up the middle again. Manning is going down. I mean, that was a jailbreak by Seattle. Wagner and Averill were there. Again, a four-man rush going for Cruz. Maxwell made the interception, and he stepped out of bounds. Byron Maxwell with his second interception in as many weeks. He took it away from Victor Cruz, and the Seahawks have yet another turnover. Second and long. Manning actually has time going against Richard Sherman, and that does not end up very well. Sherman with the interception. That's his fifth of the year, and Manning's second of the game. Lynch battling, still fighting, and he gets in. Time for Wilson. He hits Baldwin on the slant, and Baldwin gets in. Touchdown, Seattle.
And they've been punishing people ever since.
Manning going for the corner again. Sherman Thomas off the tip. Has it for Seattle. It's a touchback. And another interception, the fifth for the Seattle defense.
So the Giants then, what they showed on Sunday, going into Denver with no hope and no one classified as a wide receiver, pretty much. It has to concern the Seahawks with all the issues that the Seahawks have, like the Giants, which we'll get onto in a sec, on the offensive line. That front four with Damon Harris and JPP, it's our issues are coming against their strength, isn't it, Adam?
Yeah, and amazingly, I saw a stat today that the Seahawks have only thrown one screen pass all season thus far.
Yeah.
Which is pretty amazing, considering that everyone knows the offensive line is the main issue, that you wouldn't try and sort of work around that with screens. I mean, there's obviously been a few bubble screens to wide receivers, but one screen pass all year, I mean, probably doesn't help by the fact that most of the running backs have got bricks for hands at the minute. But, yeah, one. I'm stunned.
Yeah, that was quite a stat. I mean, yeah, it really, really spoiled. Did you? The defenses are going to run and be really aggressive against our O-line, and the easiest way to counteract that is by dumping it over onto the running back and getting 10-15 easy yards. But
especially as that's how like all the best teams play this at the minute in the NFL as well, like, you know, the Patriots and the Falcons, who, you know, obviously recency bias, last few weeks maybe not been the best, but the two teams that ripped up the NFL last year, it was probably their main focal point.
Yeah, and also, I mean, you see, Ty Montgomery made the Packers okay with getting rid of Eddie Lacy because he did that, because he was a receiver out of the backfield and could catch pass after pass when the Packers O-line wavered at the back end of last year. And he turned it into, he's their starting running back still, isn't he, Ty Montgomery?
Yeah, I mean, it looks disgusting wearing 88, and that does need to be, you know, if the league have another meeting, that should be point 1A to discuss that he has to change his number. But, he's certainly helped them out. I'm not sure they would have gone as far as they did last year. I mean, as happens, I don't think he's a particularly good running back, but fitting the mould of what they needed, I don't think they would have been as successful as they were last year without him.
No, yeah. As we just heard from James, he was quite negative on his weekend in Berkeley and obviously the Giants the rest of the season, but the Giants really did as quite an impressive win against what isn't the offense it once was, but to do that in their backyard, it's quite a defensive showing. If it was any other team, there'd be a lot more glowing terms surrounding it, wouldn't there?
Yeah, Denver's a weird team because, yeah, you immediately back them almost every week at home because they've got that swarming defense. It's a great atmosphere. But they haven't actually got that much talent if you look at it on paper. I mean, there's a few flashy names, but I still don't think the world can truly make an honest view on Trevor Siemian. But, you know, I look at the Broncos going to the Chargers this week, and despite it being, I think, 4-2 versus 2-4, I make the Chargers fairly heavy favorites there. I think the Seahawks are a much more rounded team than the Broncos. But who knows? I mean, sometimes you don't know what you're going to get out of Seattle. But then I think back over a week ago to the game against the Rams, and if the defense performs as they did then, we'll have no problems in taking care of business on Sunday, I don't think.
Yeah, I have to agree. The offense for me, Siemian, as you say, he's just a very strange quarterback to kind of, he's kind of like the Andy Dalton. When you doubt him, he does something which is pretty impressive. And then when you put the praise on him and go, oh, this is the guy kind of thing, he makes a stupid throw, which he made a couple of them on Sunday night against the Giants. But secondary with Dominique Rodgers-Cromartie back in the fold, Eli Apple, the first round pick from 2016, and Janoris Jenkins, who he was picked on early and then had quite a second half on Sunday. They're going to be a tough task for the Seahawks receivers, who have struggled really to get open consistently enough over the first 5-6 weeks of the season, haven't they?
I mean, and Landon Collins, who's probably the best of the bunch. It's not going to be easy. But we are generally fairly good at scheming Baldwin open and things like that. And as we always say, it's, you know, getting Doug involved early should open it up for Jimmy. And if we do that, we could open it up for Lockett and Richardson. There's enough talent on paper on the Seahawks to do some damage. Yeah. But, you know, the quarterback needs to step up and play properly because he hasn't done that particularly well on the road so far this season, until, you know, the Titans game was completely lost, and I don't really put much weight on that because It's always a bit easier to do that when you're in garbage time, effectively.
Yeah. On the offensive side of the ball for the Giants, Eli Manning's had a lot of questions. Obviously, James, we asked James about his 2018 and onwards, if he's going to be in New York. I think you even brought up the fact if he was going to be in New York this week with a possible move to Jacksonville or trade out of New York. But if we get into his face, we get into him early, we get, it's like literally the old football chant, get into him, F him up, isn't it, with Eli Manning?
Yeah, I mean, the good thing about playing Eli Manning is that he offers literally zero risk with his legs. Yeah. So you don't have to respect that at all. And with someone like Orleans Darkwa, Paul Perkins, I mean, the running game there is mediocre at best. Yeah. So you'd hope that with, you know, without Odell Beckham, without Brandon Marshall, who I think was probably having a rough year regardless, Sterling Shepard maybe not being there, there shouldn't be too much that you have to, you know, there's no one really there that you would expect that they would need to double team Evan Engram maybe, but you don't mind that particularly if there's no one on the outside that can hurt you. So, you know, you would hope that even if at a game that there's enough in the Seahawks 11 on defense that should be able to close down the majority of ways that the Giants, who have been so limited with injury, can hurt us.
Yeah, I think Sterling Shepard, if he can go, that will be a big plus for him. I think it's a literal 50-50 thing at this point. He's been limited in the first couple of days of practice this week. But outside of that, as you said, Evan Engram, tight ends, they've always been a thorn in the side. But how they use Evan Engram could mirror how we should be or will continue to use Jimmy Graham, isn't it, with Engram?
Yeah, and you know, the tight ends that I can remember scoring touchdowns against us are people like Greg Olsen, Tyler Eifert, obviously Gronkowski, and ultimately they've always been complemented by, you know, respectively, Kelvin Benjamin, Ted Ginn Jr., AJ Green, Giovanni Bernard at the backfield, obviously the Patriots, you know, wealth of receivers. It's not often that a tight end basically is the number one guy has done us.
Yeah,
So you'd hope that they can scheme, even if, you know, they, you know, use Richard Sherman just to travel with him in the slot, and then, you know, and Chancellor, or, you know, as long as it's not KJ Wright, obviously, you would hope that they can, especially a rookie, it would be pretty bad to get beaten up by a rookie tight end as the number one guy, despite the fact that he's in my fantasy team, if not in my actual team this weekend.
Yeah, he has shown flashes. I think last week they showed he seemed to be the first read on a lot of plays, especially in the first half when the Giants' offense showed the most. But as for the Seahawks, it's a case of just staying out our own way, isn't it, on Sunday?
Yeah, it's long drives. It's, you know, getting a nice mixture of pass and run to keep the defense honest. And hopefully, you know, integrating some screens for the first time this season into the game and just trying to be a bit different, a few jet sweeps. I think we don't need to do anything exceptionally well on offense, but I just think we need to mix it up and be positive in our play at all times.
Yeah.
And that should give us enough to get the job done. I mean, it's funny because 2 weeks ago I was looking at the rosters and thinking, oh, this is in the bag, it's going to be great. But then we have a bye week, and then you lose that sort of, you know, if you look at even on TV this week, people are saying, oh, who's the NFC favorite? Now that Rodgers has gone down, no one talks about the Seahawks because we had a bye week, so they sort of forget that you exist. And obviously the Giants have a big win, and now I'm dumping myself thinking that they're going to be the best team of all time again. So I don't know what to think, but I'm pretty confident, and the fact that obviously we'll be there adds an extra little bit of juice to it.
Yeah, and obviously, well, I think we said in WhatsApp over the last couple of days that a quick start could be a massive thing. It could be a boat race if the Seahawks get their quick start, couldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, if we can, you know, take even a, you know, ideally a two-score game, if we can somehow get it to 10-0, and then you can just save to Frank Clark, pin your ears back and get after Eli and put them in second and long and third and long, I think then we'll give ourselves a great chance to win. I mean, it's hardly a groundbreaking stuff to say get a lead and more likely to win a sports game than not, but it's one of those games that you really don't want to be falling a touchdown behind and getting the crowd, you know, 1-5 is awful, but if you're 1-5 and you're leading at half time to make it 2-5 and you've beaten the Broncos and the Seahawks, and you might see a glimmer of maybe a wild card spot opening up in the stands, and you just want to get that crowd quiet as quickly as possible and just make it a boring equivalent of a 2-0 home win against a relegation candidate.
Yeah, just and also we get a quick start, so me, you, and Terry can move down lower to the stadium. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, we need some New Yorkers to get back on the bus home so that we can move down a bit closer from. I think our current view is just lower than the top of the Empire State Building. So yeah. we'll have to see if we can do a bit of a shuffle.
Yeah, yeah, the observation deck will be getting a bit of a workout on Sunday. But yeah, the run game, we get to see Eddie Lacy play.
Yeah, I don't know why you sounded so excited about that.
because I knew it would be met with the lack of that it was.
I mean, my view on Lacy has been fairly clear. I think he's just not fit for purpose. And I think it should be Thomas Rawls every game given the start Thomas Rawls proves to me that he cannot do it. He should be given enough opportunities because, for me, he has enough credit in the bank from the past to suggest that he's good enough to carry the load.
Yeah, and he showed in the Lions game where he wasn't having a great year. He was having, obviously, the injuries from niggling. And then, all of a sudden, the playoff game, he breaks franchise records for yardage because he just kept, as you say, kept getting the ball. With all the talk of Brennan Albert, Dwayne Brown, and all the stuff going on the O-line, obviously Cliff Avril as well. Are you surprised that the team still haven't called up Mike Davis?
Maybe, but they've done this in the past where, like, Tremaine Pope and... Yeah. Who's the guy that went to Dallas?
Rod Smith.
Rod Smith. Like, they've done this a couple of times and called a guy up to give him two plays up the middle on second and six, and it's just been... I don't know, it's almost feel like a bit of a waste of time, and...
Yeah.
He showed good flashes in the preseason, but I guess if they don't think he can offer anything different, is it necessarily that useful to bring him up? I mean, what I would say about Rawls and the run game is that, you know, don't try and run behind Ibushi against JPP on first and 10, because ultimately then you just put yourself in second and 11 or second and 9. Just if you are going to accept that the run game has a problem, which I think we probably say it does, yeah, try and make it as easy for them as possible. You know, even if you can be in second and 7 and running, it just sounds a lot nicer than first and 10, because then you pick up a yard and, you know, the playbook's open with third and 6. But, you know, we've been running way too often on first and second down and 10, and it sets the tone for a 3-and-out.
Yeah, it also about 2 weeks, I think you said, or one of us said a couple of weeks ago, where when Lacy's on the field, everyone knows what's coming. So if they can find ways to change that up, maybe even with the running back screens that we mentioned have been almost absent for the first 6 weeks of the season, if they can just find new ways to use Lacy, even if he's just a decoy, it will open up so much more. Obviously, we talked about Evan Engram's usage, Jimmy Graham's usage. As we said last week's pod, has been interesting. It's been an increase of being a slot or receiver. That's going to have to continue, isn't it, against this, just to get that defensive secondary off balance a little bit.
Yeah, sorry, I realised you made that point 5 minutes ago and I took us on a completely different path, so I can only apologise for that. Look, there's only so much more I can say about Jimmy Graham at the minute. He's, you know, probably my third favourite player. I'm so firmly entrenched in the Jimmy Graham camp that, you know, I've nearly hit the earth's core. I've gone so deep in the trench. So yeah, throw him the ball and he'll make plays. Where did I see? I saw a picture of a play being made, a fade to a receiver, and it's like, and someone said, "Oh, why can't Jimmy Graham do that?" And I said, "Well, no, it should be, you know, why isn't Russell Wilson throwing it, as opposed to why Jimmy Graham will do it if you throw it to him?" But yeah, unfortunately, he can't catch his own throws. If he could, I'm sure he would.
Yeah.
But you know, someone's got to give him the ball to give him the chance to catch it.
Yeah, the playing game is still dumbfounding to me with all that. I think the fact that Russell Wilson seems averse to any blame in that kind of thing is very weird. Defense, though, for as bad as our offensive line is, theirs might be worse. Eric Flowers is Bradley Saul on steroids, isn't he, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy that they have absolutely no faith in him whatsoever. You know, he's probably the most talked about offensive lineman in the league at the minute, because every Sunday there's a different video or whatever of him, or a meme about him. So ultimately, he is just someone that you've got to attack, even if you just stick Richardson on him the whole game and say, you know, don't worry about, you know, you know, Jaron Reed will stop the run. You just work on Eric Flowers and see what you can do. You'd have to hope that would bear some fruit.
Yeah, most certainly. It's going to be interesting watch to see how our O-line copes with their defensive line. As we said, I think at the start of the season, every week there's a defensive player you can pick out which is going to cause problems. This week it is Snacks, Damon Harrison, who's just an absolute force of nature in the sense of that O-line. Really did cause the left side of the Broncos line a lot of problems on Sunday and opened up. I think JPP ended with 3.5 sacks on Sunday night. But yeah, for Seahawks, one to watch on offense, Adam?
One to watch on offense. Let's go with Tyler Lockett. I was thinking in depth about Tyler Lockett last night, as one does with their life. and I was just wondering where he's going as a player and where his career's heading. He's going into, he's in a contract year, effectively. Maybe yeah. not, but you know, he's in a position where at the end of the season he could sign a contract.
Yeah.
And you're not really getting production out of him that would suggest he would be worth the money. And, you know, I'm not sure, I'm sure there's plenty of teams that would look at him and think, you know, we can do a lot with him, but he's the type of player that you get a lot of those out of every draft in college. And yeah. I think he's a guy that, well, he needs to have the ball thrown to him, but he needs to start making some plays. Because, you know, people are very quick to say, oh, we've got loads of good receivers and we've got Baldwin, we've got Richardson, we've got Lockett. But at the minute, you're not really getting enough out of Richardson and Lockett to suggest that they're more than just gimmicky gadget players. So I think we need to reestablish the fact that Lockett is a great receiver, because he's a guy that we've seen before, can be yeah. a multiple 100-yard game a season type receiver.
Yeah, I think also with Lockett, it's the same deal on a lesser scale than Thomas Rawls. It's the injury thing is obviously you talk with Matt Clefaver, when it's that half a step less you're going to take because you're worried about what could happen. That might be something that Rawls clearly has to get over, I think, and the team have to get past with trusting Rawls. That might be the same with Tyler Lockett. I think last year when we played the Rams, you saw all the deep balls. He got injured on one of the deep throws where he just absolutely torched the defensive back. We didn't see that 10 days ago against the same team, and it's just a weird. I don't know if it's trust seems to be missing, but I do agree. I think it's time that he steps up. As Rob said last week, he probably isn't going to be renewed this over the off season 2018, but he needs to start showing that in 2019 that the team will have a decision to make. For me on offense, I just think it's that left guard spot. I think it's going to be the one that's going to line up most prominently against Damon Harrison, and he's going to be the biggest issue for that. And we just we need to just keep on the track that the O-line has been going on the last few weeks.
If that does happen, it's quite often right now you see young quarterbacks, they take a shotgun snap and really run quite hard to the right, and it looks yeah. very much like a college play. Yeah. I can't describe it until you see it, and if you know what I'm talking about, then you'll know what it means. But just run that a bit more. You know, just alleviate the pressure on the left guard, and don't put Russell in a situation where he's got to take 7-step drops out of, you know, from under center, yeah. because that is, unless you're going to, you know, you can really bank on the play action and you've got a back in there who's going to block and a tight end who's going to chip. That's how we're going to cause ourselves problems.
Yeah, I agree. I think Mitch Trubisky has basically done that on every snap.
He's running a college offense, basically.
Yeah, yeah. So it's working for him, and clearly working for Deshaun Watson. You think, doesn't Deshaun Watson lead the league in touchdown passes or something?
Mm-hmm. And he missed the first game.
Yeah, absolutely ridiculous, but at the same time, rather impressive. One to watch, though, on defense, Adam?
I'm going to go Frank Clark to back up probably his best game as a Seahawk in Los Angeles, and light up the other big city in America on Broadway and take him down.
Yeah, it's boring to agree, but I think I would agree. I think KJ Wright, I think whoever lines up against Evan Engram will be interesting to watch to see who it is. Obviously, you mentioned maybe shadowing with Sherman, but if it is KJ Wright, we need to see that. I mean, again, as Rob mentioned last week, and I think you did, he's not been too impressive.
He's one to watch from a different perspective, because we actually need to watch and see what he's got at the minute.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. Prediction though, score prediction?
I think I said to you 24-10 yesterday to the Seahawks.
Yeah, that's what I've got, yeah.
So I'll go with that.
I don't see it being a boat race, as I mentioned, if they get any. So I think I've got 26-13, something weird like that. If you go on Scorigami, whatever the Scorigami is, that'll probably happen again. Happened a few years ago in New York when Brandon Browder had a pick six and Doug Baldwin, I think he got two touchdown passes that day. It finished like 36-15 or something. bizarre. But yeah, moving on though, just other NFL news. Obviously, the Seahawks were on bye. I think Ross either tweeted or sent us a message saying that the Seahawks possibly win the bye week. But with the Rams winning and the Cardinals winning, that win in LA 10 days ago took on even more significance, didn't it?
Yeah, massive. The Rams, that was a weird game. If you look at the stat line, they had no reason to win that. I mean, Goff, again, less than 10 fantasy points. I mean, he's pish, but we all know that. but yeah, I mean, the Cardinals, it's difficult to know about Adrian Peterson, but he certainly looked like he looked like old AP there. And I think Carson Palmer's, you know, talk of his demise, I said this a few weeks ago, I think has been greatly overestimated. He looks rubbish. If you can get him to run, you can hit him. But if you give him a pocket to pass out of, that Carson Palmer's still a very good quarterback. So we certainly won the bye week in the sense that a lot of our rivals won, and you know, you don't like to say it, but Green Bay probably not becoming an issue anymore is obviously an advantage for the rest of the NFC, because for me they looked by far the best team in the NFC in the first 5 weeks. But you know, we got to get this division won, and if the Cardinals and Rams keep winning, then we have to back it up and do it ourselves.
Yeah, I think with Carson Palmer, it's a massive, massive thing having a run game. I think there cannot be many more surprising performances than Adrian Peterson last week. Like, where on earth that came from last week is no idea, because you'd expect that the Buccaneers with Gerald McCoy in the heart of that defensive line would be able to stop Adrian Peterson. He just looked like he 18 months ago looked like he'd finished, and then he popped off, was it 2 touchdowns, 130 yards and stuff, like it's 2007 all over again. So I think if that, it was going to be something to watch for the Cardinals, because if they keep Peterson going, and obviously you don't know really what the situation with David Johnson is, but if they can linger around where they are now and stay in contention in the NFC West, which is possibly likely unless the Seahawks really turn it on in the next few weeks, that run game is huge for the Cardinals, where the defense still continues to struggle, because they tried their best to give up a 31-0 lead, didn't they, on Sunday? They tried their best.
I mean, I tweeted halfway through that game that I think I'm not convinced that Ryan Fitzpatrick is that much of a drop off on Jameis Winston this season, because Jameis does not look good at all. I think you always get the hard knocks boost with teams, and it's a very good way to make you believe that they're better than they are. But I generally thought there was something in this Tampa Bay team, but Winston just doesn't look like he's learning from mistakes. He's too erratic with the ball. Obviously the talent's there to be a good player, but in the same way as Wentz went second behind Goff, looks a bit silly. I think Mariota looks, if he can stay healthy, a considerably better quarterback than Jameis Winston does right now.
Yeah, I'd agree. Also, talking of the Colts, it's a weird, worried if you're a Colts fan situation, Andrew Luck, isn't it? He's been pulled out of practice again. He looks like he's going to be out for another 10 days. Won't be able to practice for 10 days. He's had another cortisone shot in his injured shoulder, which is he's starting to feel soreness in yet again. That's a strange situation. It's a mishandling of a franchise quarterback like we haven't seen in quite a while, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, if I were them, I would say, you're done for the year, Andrew. Thank you very much. Play Jacoby Brissett, who I don't think he's a flash in the pan. I think he's genuinely a decent player. I think you trade him for picks, and then you trade those picks for more picks, and you just try and own the draft next year. Because I think there'll be someone out there that will give you a high first round pick for Brissett, because if he looks good, then someone's going to take it, especially, you know, a team like Cleveland who have got loads of picks. And then you can either use that pick on a quarterback, or you trade that pick for, again, another boatload of picks, and you know, they could have 10, 11 picks, of which 5 or 6 are very high in the draft next year. But I don't see what they'd be gaining from playing an injured Luck and not playing a Brissett who can flash and maybe earn them something in the future.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think Brissett has really, really showed. So I think how bad the Colts are in the second half is a very underrated storyline, because they just continue to just collapse and capitulate in the second half.
I think they've been outscored ago, like 82-14 in fourth quarters this season.
Incredible. I went to bed on Monday night, and I think it was 12-20 or 12-19 or something, and I woke up and see that the Titans won quite handily. It was just Very, very strange. But yeah, elsewhere in the NFL, also talking about quarterbacks, talking about Indianapolis Colts quarterbacks, who one person who probably should be in that quarterback room in some form or another. Colin Kaepernick has made the move to sue the NFL. We obviously spoke about Kaepernick and all that, how he's just absolutely scandalous, really, at this point, and just laughable that he isn't employed. What do you make of his legal step, Adam?
So I listen to the Adam Carolla show most days, and he is friendly with Mark Garagos, who is the lawyer who's taken the case on. And I think what the intention is to take this legal is that they're hoping to find a smoking gun. So they think that they can find an email from Roger Goodell, which will say something like, to all the owners, do not sign Colin Kaepernick. And I think that's what they're hanging their hat on, because if they can't find that, it's pretty hard to prove anything, I would imagine. So I think that's the intention, and best of luck to them, I guess, because it's just becoming a farcical situation. It's more of a distraction now than the distraction a team would face if they signed him in June.
Yeah, I think, and there's a lot of people, I mean, I posted, I don't know why I did it, but I posted it on the Facebook group on Sunday night. Instead of enjoying the Broncos game, I got into the age-old argument at this point about Colin Kaepernick and why he isn't playing, why he should be playing, and this and that, and all the words cancer, locker room, and all that came up. Go and listen to what Jed York said about Colin Kaepernick yesterday. Go and read about how Joe Staley, Navarro Bowman, spoke about Kaepernick over the summer. He isn't a cancer. He's the one who started this message that people like Jerry Jones have taken for their own whatever vanity, I guess, at this point. So the step is a ballsy one, really, to sue the basically your employer that you want a job off. It's quite a ballsy move, but the fact, I mean, didn't the lawyer defend Michael Jackson in his legal issues? Is that something I read? And that's quite a high flying lawyer to do for a case like this. But I think it's going to be difficult for him to prove anything, but I think he only needs 12. He needs to prove that there is liability for 12 or 13 in the clubs, and he's got a case which could even bring down the CBA, which will open up a whole new and whole different can of worms heading into the rest of the season, obviously, and more intently 2018. So it would be interesting to watch, and all the best wishes to him, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know what the end game here is, because it's just the whole thing is just such a mess. But yeah, I mean, of course, best of luck to him. And you know, he's brought issues to rise that, unfortunately, ironically, it's one of those things that the more publicity it gets, the more the focus on the issue gets lost, because you get a lot of white noise surrounding it and people twisting the narratives to their own purpose. And people have actually forgotten the whole reason that this all started now, because it's now all flag and anthem, and it was nothing to do with that. No. So hopefully he can find some clarity and get back in the league, because if he clearly wants to be, and there's too many shit quarterbacks, and I want to watch a decent one.
Exactly. There's a bit of a lot of talk about how bang average the NFL is, and it doesn't help. A lot of that is down to the fact that some of the quarterbacks, as are listed and got board listing on Sunday night, are playing. But talking of flag, if there's an amazing picture, which is done the rounds earlier in the week on social media, of a Jets fan, I think he is, wearing a t-shirt where he's saying, "I stand for the anthem," as he sits down on the American flag, drinking a beer through the straw. So, yeah, but never mind.
Beer through the straw is the most disrespectful part of that whole picture.
That took a few seconds longer for you to say than I thought it would. I was setting you up for that.
I don't care to interrupt.
It's okay. Lock or shot, then. Adam, you've had 40-odd minutes to make your pick. Lock or shot for this week?
I will go my lock of the week. I will go the Steelers against the Bengals. I think that the Steelers will find a bit of rhythm now. And I think it'll be a good game, a close game, but I think the Steelers will get that done. And I'm going to go my shock of the week. I don't know if this really counts, but I'm going to go for, just because in the start of the season you would never have considered this, I'm going to say the Bills take down Tampa Bay at home on Sunday.
Yeah. Well, my shock of the week is going to be the opposite to your lock of the week. I think the Bengals are going to beat the Steelers on Sunday.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think that defensive secondary can be eaten alive by AJ Green on Sunday. And I think lock of the week will be the... It's... It's dangerous to say, but I think it's probably going to have to be the Seahawks, I think.
Oh, no, no, no. The Browns exist, Stuart.
I know, but...
If the Browns exist, then there is a tighter lock.
I didn't see you. I just saw the Titans on my pick sheet. Yeah, yeah.
Change it for me, please.
Yeah. I will do. For your sanity and because I'm standing next to you on Sunday night.
To the listener, just please forget that you heard that, okay? Come on, the listener. We don't need to be... I don't want to rake over old ground, but come on, we'll park that, okay? Thank you.
Yeah, the Titans beat the Browns. I just saw the Titans listed. I didn't see who they were playing. So yeah, Titans to beat the Browns. Quick update, I guess, on the college game this weekend. The BT Sport, the big game, comes our early hours of Sunday morning. Michigan against, or in UK, it comes as Michigan head to play Penn State. The Michigan offense are finding new ways to make games tight and nearly lose to Indiana last weekend. And Penn State have possibly the best running back and tight end combination in college ball this year. Also, college, the massive deflating loss on Saturday night for the Huskies, and then all the injuries that have come from it, Adam.
Yeah, that was pretty rough. I had to go to do a catering job very early on Sunday morning, so I woke up to go to work when the fourth quarter was still on, and just following it and thinking that, you know, we'll get back into it, but they cooked it up. But let's not forget that the Cougars also lost to Cal 37 to like 6, so
yeah,
back in your box.
Yeah, when the Cal Bears just give up yards.
Yeah, you lost to Michael Silver, so you know that's gotta hurt.
Yeah, I was quite happy for James. I think James enjoyed it through all the potential of coughing up blood that come with standing in that stadium in Berkeley last Friday night. But he seemed to enjoyed it quite a lot. He said all the smoke was coming from the Cal Bears defense being on fire.
Not innocent owls.
But yeah, if we get involved with the Pedestrian Podcast, we have had someone, the first person, who has become the top level patron. We'll talk more about that next week and then try and get them on. Also, they'll sponsor a few shows, which is all part of that package at the top. So thank you very much to that person. Yeah, before I get involved, thepedestrianpodcast.podbean.com, thepedestrianpodcast on iTunes, the Pedestrian Podcast on Instagram, on Facebook as well, Seahawkers UK on Twitter, the UK Seattle Seahawks fans on Facebook, personal Twitter is @stu_core, @AdamDNathan, @RossBow1984. We will be back, obviously, next week to preview the Texans game. I think that's the one after this, isn't it, Adam?
Yes, I think it is.
It is. So we'll be back some point next week. Obviously, travel dependent as well. To the Seahawkers guys, if you listen to that, we will hopefully see you some point on Saturday and Sunday at Carlo East or in the MetLife parking lot somewhere. But until the next time, this has been the Pedestrian Podcast.
Go Hawks!
That is
going to
do it. 12, they're bringing the trophy home. Your Seahawks, Super Bowl 48 champions.